Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And therefore, we have this complicated situation where we have to fight to minimize the damage that the system of competition and greed is unleashing on people, at the same time that we have to convince more and more of those people who we're working with that there is another way and that eventually that's the way we're going to solve these problems.
That's the voice of author and economist Robin Hennell. On this week's show, Robin talks about the root causes of the economic crisis and the need to move forward with alternative systems and a new Green Deal. So stay tuned.
And we're very privileged to be joined by Dr. Robin Hennell. Robin Hennell is a professor emeritus at Portland State University. He is also the author of many books. His latest focus has been on participatory economics and how we transition our social movements into a platform for change. So very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Now, Robin, when we look at the media today, the story that we're told seems to be a very dark story that seems the capitalism's here to stay, that there's no escaping. You know, retroactively, if you were to examine what has happened in the last few years, 2013 was a significant year for people who have been aware of what neoliberalism has signaled for workers. Can we talk a little bit about this liberalization that has not only privatized postal services in the European Union, but it's now doing that in Canada. Also, the significance that this has had for workers, as we see a monopoly of very small interest groups consolidating effectively their power through economic means.
The neoliberalization of most national economies and the global economy began way back in the 1980s, so it's a process that's been going on for 40 years now. And for a while, it appeared to produce what appeared to be prosperity in Europe and North America in the advanced economies. And the only problems were crises that were taking place in the less developed economies. We had the lost decade of the 80s, the debt crisis in Latin America and Africa. We had the financial crisis in Mexico in 1995. We had the East Asian financial crisis and all of the economic havoc that wreaked, the Argentine crisis in 2001. But all these problems seem to be taking place in third world countries, and things looked at that point, or at least we were told, things were going very well, you know, for people in North America and Europe. Now, it's become apparent that even those good times were actually not good times. Now we know that literally all of the productivity gains of the economies over that 30-year time period were being sopped up by as profits as people's wages were stagnating. Well, we now know that wages have stagnated and real incomes were constant from roughly 1980 right up to the economic crisis of 2008. It didn't feel that way because we had a housing market bubble and we were going farther in debt, so we were able to continue to consume, but it wasn't because our income was going up. And then in 2008, finally the chickens came home to roost in the greatest economic financial crisis and now continuing recession, Great Recession, since the Great Depression. So now it's become apparent, you know, things really aren't going well. That, yes, the banks and the corporations' profits have recovered, but we still have just unacceptable joblessness. We have budget crises. We have school systems that are falling apart. And that this is going on in Europe, and this is going on in North America. And that the dominant response of governments has been not to do anything effective to regulate the financial sector that created the crisis in the first place and continues to function and operate in a way that can continue to make crises in the future. Crisis is brewing right now in Turkey. another financial crisis, and in Argentina. So the financial system hasn't been reformed. It hasn't been changed, which is very different from what happened in the Great Depression. That financial crisis led to real financial reform that worked for 30, 40 years. This latest financial crisis that hit in 2008 has not led to significant reform. The other change is that in the response to the Great Depression, we finally had governments come in and use fiscal stimulus to put people back to work. And instead, the dominant response of the ruling groups in the advanced economies has been to impose fiscal austerity rather than fiscal stimulus. It's perpetuated the recession and the joblessness of the recovery. And that continues to this very day.
It's interesting that you point out not only the historical process of how domination and exploitation had become almost the status quo. And it's something that we're always told it's an inevitable foe. You know, we wish that we could give everybody livable wages, but it's just unrealistic. And so this idea of austerity sounds like a big word. It's used a lot in the media, but no one ever really defines, no one ever really tells us what are they talking about. You know, austerity just seems like a very nice word to hide. What to me seems to be a very dark process of stealing from the poor effectively to enlarge the gains of those who are wealthy. But you as an economist have ways of seeing this. You know, the economic theory of free market, it's almost theology in our society. So how should we understand this?
What we now realize was that corporations in the financial sector were literally waging incredibly successful class war in Europe and the United States from 1980 right up through the 2000s. That's now clear. Occupy and the whole 1% versus 99%, 99% were stagnant, 1% were gobbling up all the productivity gains for decades and decades and decades. That has now broken into people's consciousness. What has happened since the crisis is rather amazing. When ruling elites created the economic crisis and the Great Depression, those ruling elites actually responded. They were pushed. I'm not saying they were not pushed by mass movement. I'm not saying that many of them, you know, were forced to do things they never wanted to do. But nonetheless, the mass movements succeeded in moving ruling elites to effective policies to lessen the pain and to get us out of the Great Depression. They moved ruling elites to financial reform. Wall Street didn't want financial reform in the 1930s, but ruling elites said we have to do this. And the ruling elites and corporations did not want a new deal. They didn't want stimulus. They didn't want fiscal policy. They didn't want works programs. But ruling elites went ahead and did that in both Europe and the United States. The difference this time is that there has not been enough popular pressure on ruling elites to force them to do policies that would actually help ordinary people. And instead what they've done is they have turned the crisis into something that they can use to further wage even more vicious class war. And that is what the austerity is. The austerity is simply punishing innocent victims in ways that has no end. The kind of punishment that's being meted out in Greece, in Spain, in Ireland, for the overwhelming majority of the population, is not, their economies are not improving. The degree to which their governments are in debt is not improving. Well, why is it being done? Well, it's basically a Trojan horse for simply pounding away and eliminating all of the vestiges of the safety nets, the welfare programs, and really destroying the middle class. Ruling elites in the advanced economies simply don't fear or care about the middle class. Until now, the difference between this crisis and the last great economic crisis in the advanced economies is that the ruling elites have persisted in policies that are not improving the economic situation, but simply operating in their own very narrow self-interest.
So can we talk a little bit then about the the opportunities that this crisis offer in bringing people together and reimagining perhaps ourselves in new ways, you know, in a participatory democracy that invites everyone?
Well, it's certainly not the case that there haven't been popular movements that have arisen to oppose the kind of just incredible, excessive austerity and oppression, you know, that governments have been imposing on people. First of all, it's important to understand that these policies, this sort of ratcheting up the class war to make it even more vicious, those policies have been implemented by right-wing governments and by center-left governments. The social democrat in Greece, both center-left and center-right governments have presided over austerity. In Spain, both center-right and center-left governments have presided over austerity. In the United States, the Obama administration is seen as sort of a center-left government, and it has presided over austerity really in a way that's very indistinguishable from what the Bush administration. In Canada, it has been a Harper government, a conservative government. In England, it's been a conservative, a Tory government. There's no major political party in the advanced world that has not presided over essentially the same policies, the austerity, continuation of class war, and sort of hopelessly counterproductive policies that aren't, they're not fixing the financial system, and they're not giving people jobs, and they're not overcoming the fact, the crisis of the public sector, where school systems and healthcare systems are literally just falling apart. That's the first thing to understand. Now, we've had responses. Greece was one of the first places. It was a massive response, and it was a massive response of sort of old reform groups, the unions and the social workers, and also much younger people, the autonomous movement, the sort of the anarchist movement. Both responded at different times in different ways in massive protests. The Indignados was the, you know, in Spain, was a massive, you know, response and just a scream of no, this austerity is unfair and it's unacceptable and it's completely counterproductive. It took longer in the United States. First, we had the response in Wisconsin to a governor that was literally just trying to bust the unions. And that was a response of more or less traditional progressive organization. And then a year and a half later came Occupy, which was a whole different segment of the body populace, and it was a whole different flavor in terms of what it was that Occupy was saying and what it was saying was unacceptable and that it wanted instead. So these kinds of things have happened. The Arab Spring, which I don't really think, if you look at the Arab Spring, yes, the economic situation in Egypt and those countries was bad. But they weren't primarily uprisings about an economic crisis. I mean, those were uprisings against authoritarian political regimes. And in Egypt, a whole military officer corps and elite military units that were living high off the hog while everybody else was basically getting nothing. So I think that was an uprising, and it was also an uprising against their government's sort of quisling cooperation with U.S. and Israeli domination of the Arab sphere of the world. We have seen things happen, but to this point, they have not produced system change, although we see more and more thinking and more interest in, well, this isn't working, it's still not working, they're not fixing anything. There's more and more interest in system change. That's a good thing. It also makes the resistance more powerful the more people believe that system change is possible. And there's more and more resistance to just the debacles, you know, that the current policies are continuing to create. But they have not moved. All of that has not yet moved major governments of major countries to really change their policy course the way that ruling governments did change the policy course in the Great Depression, finally.
We can look at the social movements worldwide, perhaps, as one part of multiple pieces coming together. Because although we can see the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela completely, you know, revamping their economic and political system, there's also a lot of areas that they need to overcome because they're still in a capitalist society. They're still participating in the capitalist system. I think we do both. We look at capitalism as this, you know, cancer, effectively, that pits us against one another and makes workers compete on an unequal status, you know, first-class workers and lower-class workers, migrant and settled, you know, people with documents. All the kind of ways that we're put against each other. And if you put that, you know, as part of one part of the puzzle and then look at what is happening, you know, when we see a growing movement, I would disagree with you that the movements in both Tunis and in Egypt were not driven by political decisions that were made in terms of trade, you know, the massive drought, the kind of hunger that is, you know, rampant throughout Africa has a huge impact on why people rise up, why people are rising up, you know, whether it's in Africa or Latin America. So perhaps if we could talk a little bit about the way we participate, perhaps, and how we come together to perhaps reimagine a new transnational movement of people, reimagining our relations in a participatory way, in a reciprocal, responsible way, you know, where we all share in the responsibility of what we leave behind, because we have one earth and we can't all continue to consume the way we do. We can't all continue to subject each other to domination and oppression the way we have. So how do we overcome those barriers of seeing, perhaps, in many ways, that's just our ability to see beyond a capitalist system, beyond a state-dictated, you know, society where we can have both the individual qualities of who we are as individuals and the collective power of reimagining economics and society in different ways.
The way that I think and talk about this is that there's different ways that we can organize our economic affairs. One is we can basically have an economic system that is all about competition, greed, and fear. That people are motivated by greed and fear, and people are put in situations where they have to compete against one another, and that's the way the system works. That's what capitalism is. That's increasingly been the dominant mode of economic activity and how we've organized our economic affairs over the past, you know, 400 years. And it's gotten more and more and more that way. Now, I do not believe, and many of us, you know, throughout the last few hundred years, have strongly believed that that is not necessary. That, in fact, that people are perfectly capable of engaging in what I call the economics of equitable cooperation. We can cooperate equitably with one another, and we don't need capitalists, and we don't need commissars to tell us what to do and how to do it. We are capable of equitable cooperation. And that's a democratic self-management of our own affairs in an equitable cooperative way. The problem is most people don't truly believe that's possible yet. We have to reconvince a majority of people that that kind of thing is possible. We have to convince them that they want to set up a system that's different, that works in a different way, and that it is possible. And that's one struggle we have to engage in, and you know I spent a lot of time doing that. On the other hand, the situation has gotten so bad for so many people now in the first world, not just the third world, that you cannot distance yourself from the day-to-day fights to simply protect people, you know, from you know, truly terrible oppression. And therefore, we have this complicated situation where we have to fight to minimize the damage that the system of competition and greed is unleashing on people, at the same time that we have to convince more and more of those people who we're working with that there is another way and that eventually that's the way we're going to solve these problems. That's really the name of the game and has been the name of the game for 150 years now. And it hasn't changed, and In some ways, we've made some progress toward playing that game better and more effectively. In some ways, we aren't as effective as we've been at certain points in the past. That's the nature of the game, and that's the struggle we're involved in, and there's nothing else to do but to get about it and for everybody to pitch in and do the best they can.
As I listen to you, I also know that we've learned a few lessons along the way. Personally, I think that coming to terms with this idea that we take for granted that capitalism has created certain things for us, you know, like a very comfortable system that provides education or health, and realizing that no, capitalism didn't do that. We as a people, you know, coming together, achieve that in spite of capitalism, in spite of the resistance that we got from the capitalists. So I think some of the lessons and noting the lessons that we've learned along our struggles is as important as, you know, what we envision for the future. How do we create this new commons of reciprocity, of openness, of sharing, of, you know, shared responsibility? Because ultimately, that's what we need to transition to. A world where we feel responsible for the pollution that we dumped on a third world country to have cars, you know, 24/7.
You know, the fact that so many people have recently started thinking and talking about the commons. These are people in these day-to-day struggles, you know, for jobs, you know, to keep their school system from being shut down. And the fact that the language that there now is talk about the commons, and that's a very, very important sort of intellectual step in the right direction. Because the truth of the matter is that all of the natural environment and all of the machines and all of the technology that's out there, that is the commons that actually belongs to all of us. Every generation, that is what we inherit from everybody who went before us. And that is what it is that we need to manage and use as the commons, protecting, preserving, and making sure that it's sustainable, and managing to use it in a way that is cooperative and equitable and fair. That was one of the wonderful steps forward we made. I mean, Occupy was such a wonderful step forward when it just said the emperor has no clothes. Haven't you noticed that even during the good times under neoliberalism, that ordinary people were making no progress, and the wealthy were gobbling up all the productivity increases, our productivity increases? That was an incredible mental step forward. And the idea that we now need to be thinking about the commons and all this technology and all these machines and all these things that are more productive and make things more productive, that puts the lie to the message that we have no choice but to accept austerity. A year and a half ago when I was in Scandinavia, these were economies that pioneered the welfare state, that produced all sorts of public spending and programs. And they were being told, well, we have to cut all that back because we can't afford it anymore. And people in my audiences would say, I would ask them, didn't you like free education right up through the university? Didn't you like, you know, your health care system that was free for all? Didn't you like these things and you're safe? And they said, oh, of course we like it. I said, well, then why are you allowing them to be taken away? I said, first of all, if you decided they weren't so good, that you really liked something else instead, then I could understand. And I'm asking you, because maybe you decided these weren't so good. They said, oh, no, they really were good and we really, really miss them. So I would ask, well, why are you letting people take them away? Well, because we can't afford them anymore. But that's ridiculous. Their economies are three times more productive than they were in 1970. That means they can afford three times more of anything and everything than they could. We need to help people understand that when they say you have to give these things up, the only reason we have to give these things up is because they want to take more. Not because we collectively don't have more. But even so, the name of the game remains, how do we more successfully fight to protect people at the same time that we help more and more people understand that there are better ways to do things besides just trusting competition and greed, trusting the free market. Right, free market finance, that really worked well, trusting that. We need to keep hammering away at that until more and more people understand it. Certainly ruling elites are giving us nothing but opportunities to do so.
In many ways, the ecological crisis has not only woken up a lot of people in the North, but for us in Latin America, where indigenous people have been, you know, in a struggle against colonialism for over 500 years, the struggle has always been for survival. And recognizing that our interdependence is interlinked to our own survival is central to how we walk, how we see one another, how we engage with one another, and the responsibilities that we take for one another. And perhaps I think this is that catalyst moment, you know, where we come together, where we overcome those doctrines of racism, of sexism, and all the multitude of ways that we've been separated, and actually unite and create a new social way of being, a new organizing of our society on terms of reciprocity, of fairness. Your book is Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis. In closing, tell our audience why you wrote this book and why is this a significant moment for us to look not only at the ecology of our society, you know, in terms of political, social, but also our relationship to the earth.
By the way, I completely agree with you that if you look around the world, indigenous societies in Canada, the United States, and in Latin America and third world countries have long been more sensitive to how it is that human beings need to interact and treat the natural environment. They've been victims of aggressive capitalist corporations that are unsustainably just attacking nature and taking resources out and dumping waste back in. They've been victims of that, and they've been fighting against that for hundreds and hundreds of years now. They're a wise voice of wisdom in what must be a much larger movement where a majority of people on the planet are going to have to press their governments to actually do something about climate change before it's too late. I truly believe that if we do not get some significant changes in government's climate policy and in international negotiations, by the time we get to the meetings in Paris at the end of 2015, we will have crossed thresholds that really mean that we have done damage that can't be undone easily. So yes, in addition to an economic crisis, when the middle classes and ordinary people are discovering, even in the advanced economies, that they are under attack and that they have no future in the eyes of the people running the show, we have to not only do something about that, we have to do something about climate change before it's too late. The answer to both problems is a Green New Deal. We have to have mandatory reductions by nations. They have to be enforced, but those reductions have to be calculated and set in a way that's according to differential responsibility and capability. That the countries that are wealthiest and have put the most carbon up there, they have to bite the bullet bigger and steeper. And that's what the negotiations are going to all be about. The meetings in Lima in 2014 at the end of this year, and then really the critical meetings in Paris in 2015. If we don't have real progress on a significant and real international climate treaty by then, I think we're in a lot of trouble.
Thank you very much for being with us. Tell our audience so they can access your book, Green Economics, Confronting the Ecological Crisis.
Emmy Sharp was the publisher of that. You can get it any place you want. Yes, it was great being on with you, and good luck to everybody who's fighting the good fight.
Thank you again for being with us. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.